United States government.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Joe Biden met Tuesday with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau in his first bilateral meeting with a foreign leader since taking office last month. And Biden told Trudeau that the United States has no closer friend than Canada. He said this is why Trudeau was the first phone call to a world leader that he made after becoming president, and why he was the first person with whom Biden held a bilateral meeting. Trudeau thanked Biden for stepping up in such a way on tackling climate change. He said U.S. leadership had been sorely missed over the past few years. Because of the coronavirus pandemic, the meeting took place virtually. Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris, and other U.S. officials all wearing dark masks at a long table in the White House meeting room and spoke with Trudeau via video screen. White House officials said that the agenda for the meeting included the pandemic, economic recovery, climate change, refugees, and migration, fighting for democratic values around the globe, and strengthening democracies at home. There was at least one point of tension. That's Biden recently blocking the $8 billion Keystone XL pipeline project to pump oil from Canada to the United States. As more Americans are vaccinated, Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, says new guidelines for vaccinated people will be coming soon from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He told CNN that Americans will be hearing about how they can relax the stringency of some safety measures, particularly among vaccinated family members. Already, medical authorities have said people who have been vaccinated do not need to quarantine if they come in contact with an infected person. This is VOA News. Protesters in Myanmar took part in yet another day of demonstrations against the country's military junta. The demonstrations are taking place in defiance of a warning on Myanmar state television saying protesters are inciting a confrontation that could lead to loss of life. Already, at least three people have died in the protest. People in Myanmar have been demonstrating daily since February 1st, when the military detained democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other members of the civilian government. The junta claims the November election, won in a landslide by Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy, was subject to widespread election fraud. The United States and other Western nations have demanded the release of Suu Kyi and her lieutenants and called on the junta to restore power to the civilian government. The Biden administration has imposed sanctions on several members of the junta. The United Nations is expected to hold a meeting about Myanmar on Friday. The United Nations said Tuesday that civilian deaths and injuries in Afghanistan declined by 15% last year, but increased in the final 3 months after peace talks between the government and Taliban insurgents began in September. In its annual report documenting casualties, a UN assistance mission in Afghanistan said that instead of helping alleviate the scale of civilian harm, the so-called intra-Afghan peace negotiations led to an escalation of violence with disturbing consequences. It said that civilian casualties increased by 45% in the fourth quarter of last year in comparison to the same period in 2019. The number of civilians killed and injured in November was the highest of any November since the mission began systematically documenting Afghan casualties 12 years ago. The president of the Democratic Republic of Congo is now urging the Central African Nations Investigative Services to identify those responsible for the assassination Monday of Italy's ambassador and two other people in an attack on a World Food Program convoy in the country. Late Monday, he condemned the deadly attack, which took place earlier in the day near Goma and near Kivu province. He said those involved must be brought to justice. However, the Associated Press reports Italian state TV said Monday night the ambassador's convoy was targeted by a group seeking a kidnapping ransom, but the sources of the broadcast report were not revealed. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, February 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Niger's ruling party candidate wins presidential runoff election.
Reacting to his election, the elect president Mohamed Bazoum speaks a lot about the challenges which await him, and he has insisted on the related to security with the terrorist act posed the same day of the vote.
The U.S. military readies for a major African exercise. Guinea receives Ebola vaccine as neighbors take steps to prevent a regional outbreak. A Nigerian reporting app helps survivors avoid stigma. And Kenya's constitutional amendment bill moves one step closer to a referendum.
Because Tuesday we want to get 24 counties approving BBI bill. This is going to help us to move to the next stage.
Botswana's president calls for regional cooperation on poaching, and we'll speak this morning with a Guinean filmmaker about illegal immigration to Europe. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Niger ruling party candidate Mohamed Bazoum has won Sunday's presidential runoff election, defeating opposition candidate and former president Mahamat Usman. On the line from Niamey is journalist Abdul Razak. Good morning, Abdul, and welcome to Daybreak Africa.
Morning, James, and morning to all the listeners of Daybreak Africa program.
What is the mood in Niger after Mohamed Bazoum was declared the winner of the runoff election?
Well, let's say that the atmosphere in Niamey is calm after the proclamation of the result of this Sunday runoff elections. Few hours before and after this proclamation of the result, there were indeed young supporters of the candidate Mahamat Usman who put up barricades and burned tires in certain areas of the city. The police have dispersed most of these young people. Similar incidents were also reported in other regions of the country, notably in Zander.
What is opposition candidate and former president Mahamat Usman saying about the results?
Well, the opposition candidate Mahamat Usman is in Zander, his hometown, where he has voted. It is therefore his campaign manager who gave a message from him to the press here in Niamey, the capital. Message in which he described the proclamation of the result of these elections as a holdup, and he asked the population of Niger to mobilize to stop this.
As you know, Abdul, now is the time for the hard work to begin for President-elect Bazoum. As we discussed the other day on Monday, he faces numerous challenges. Has he said anything about how he intends to run the country?
Well, reacting to his election, the elect president Mohamed Bazoum speak a lot about the challenges which await him, and he has insisted on the related to security with the terrorist act posed the same day of the vote. These events are a reminder, he said, of the urgency and enormity of this security challenge. I will lead this fight with method and determination, said Mohamed Bazoum. He also added that he knows the country perfectly. He has a great knowledge of the state, and he feels in a position to assume this function that the people have decided to entrust to him. He also said that he will assume this function with patriotism, loyalty, and probity. And he concluded by saying that he will be the president of all the people of Niger without distinction.
As you said, Mahamat Usman is challenging the results. So what is the process in Niger when an election result has been challenged?
Well, the process of challenging result is provided by the electoral code. The grievances are addressed to the Constitutional Court, with the arguments and proofs. The court examines and rules within a time limit, and its decisions are final.
That was journalist Abdul Razak in the Nigerian capital, Niamey. West African countries are taking steps to prevent a regional outbreak of Ebola after the deadly virus killed at least 5 people in Guinea. The last outbreak several years ago killed more than 11,000 people. Anne Riesenberg reports from Bamako, Mali.
As Guinea launched an Ebola vaccination drive Tuesday, after an outbreak in the West African nation's southern Zedekore region, its neighbors were also preparing. The last Ebola outbreak in 2013 also started in Guinea and killed 11,300 people over 3 years as it spread to Liberia and Sierra Leone. There were also cases in Mali, Nigeria, and Senegal, and as far away as Europe and the United States. The Ebola outbreak this month was traced to a funeral for a nurse who was suspected to have died of the virus. Out of 4 confirmed and 4 probable cases, a total of 5 people have died. Zedekore, the capital of the region, is the second biggest city in Guinea and a regional transport hub. Neighboring Sierra Leone declared a level 2 emergency response. Doctors Without Borders' Lindis Hiram in Kenema District, one of the region's hardest hit by the last outbreak, says they are now better prepared.
Both the government, the Ministry of Health, and the population themselves, they are, will be more prepared this time for Ebola just because of the fact that they lived through that really large and painful outbreak in 2014-16. So, and this we see already, that people know what it is now.
In neighboring Mali, which was largely spared from the last Ebola outbreak, authorities were focused on the country's borders. Dr. Akrodi Ag Iknine is the director of Mali's National Institute for Public Health. He says a team of health workers went to the border the day after Guinea declared the February 14th outbreak. Iknine says, the next day, we went to the border at Kore Mali, between Mali and Guinea, to see some of the measures being taken. We noted, he says, that the measures are in place to reinforce the border with equipment and personal protective equipment, PPE, and to reactivate the vigilance team there, who were already set in motion in 2014 during the last epidemic. During the last outbreak, non-Ebola-related healthcare was severely impacted because of the strain the deadly virus put on the region's healthcare systems. While Guinea works to prevent the outbreak from spreading, Doctors Without Borders Hiram says in Sierra Leone, they will remain community-focused.
We know that the lessons learned from last time are very clear, and it's to involve the community in all aspects from day one, because they are the ones affected and they are the ones we need to listen to and engage with in order to stop the transmission.
Ebola vaccines were developed after the 2013 West African outbreak and have already been used in the Democratic Republic of the Congo's 2018 outbreak. The World Health Organization delivered 11,000 doses of Ebola vaccine to Guinea on Monday evening and has teams helping with the vaccination campaign. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako.
Reported rapes in Nigeria have tripled during the COVID-19 pandemic to a few thousand, but the UN Children's Fund says 1 in 4 girls have been victims of sexual violence, meaning countless thousands of rapes are going unreported. A Nigerian programmer has created an application for rape survivors to report the attacks and seek help while avoiding social stigma. Percy DeMarc reports from Yola, Nigeria.
22-year-old Nigerian student Angela Felix, not her real name, says her cousin raped her during last year's pandemic lockdown. Too ashamed to tell her family or police, she instead considered suicide until she stumbled onto a mobile application that probably saved her life.
What got at my attention with the app was the fact that I don't need to be in touch with the person before stating my case or getting help. So I actually decided to try that. And then I downloaded the app, I stated my case, and you could imagine, like, immediately I got help.
The Smart RR app allows rape victims to report the crime to authorities without going to the police in person. Users can also get counseling and support online. It effectively shields the identity of women who previously wouldn't report the rape due to fear or stigma. The app is currently operational in the state of Adamawa, Cross Rivers, Lagos, and Borno. Its creator, Diruk Samuel, says he was motivated by the rise in reported rape cases during the lockdown.
Kind of solving the issue of stigma, because you can report to a service provider and you can be in contact with the service provider with necessarily, like, I mean, without nobody knowing that you've asked for help from someone except you, the service provider, and perhaps the perpetrator that knows what happened. So with that, it increases reporting.
The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, says one in four Nigerian girls and women have been victims of sexual violence. But only a few thousand rapes are reported each year across the whole of Nigeria, a country of more than 200 million people, meaning countless thousands of rapes are going unreported. That's crippling the fight against rapists, say activists. The Hope and Rural Aid Foundation's Bibiana Adams hopes the app can help.
There are so many referral channels, but we discover that the Smart RR is easier. Guiding principles are inclusive. The need for confidentiality is there. So you can't even use it without the consent of the survivors.
While better reporting should help, critics say Nigeria's legal system still fails most rape survivors. Sadat Umar is with the Nigerian Association of Female Lawyers in Nigeria's northeastern Adamawa State.
The issue of conviction is a big issue, and it's a big step for us. If we can have a conviction, it will serve as deterrent to others. That will minimize the cases of rape.
Despite the jump in reported rapes during the pandemic, Nigeria's National Police Force said last year there were only 103 convictions nationwide. Percy Dabang for VOA News, Yola, Nigeria.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, February 24th. The U.S. military will roar back to life on the African continent after a year of pandemic-induced dormancy, officials say, with a major military exercise. With that and other efforts, they say they hope to reestablish the U.S. as the continent's top security partner. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The largest U.S.-led military exercise in Africa was shelved in 2020 amid pandemic concerns. This June, it will return, says Major General Andrew Rolling, one of the top U.S. military leaders overseeing the continent. This year's exercise will be held in Morocco, Senegal, and Tunisia.
This year, when we designed African Lion 21, we specifically designed it to be flexible, to be able to adapt with where the world and each country of Africa were in the fight against COVID, to be able to execute some form of an exercise, and then we'll well down the road in being able to do that. And so in this year, we'll conduct African Lion with about 10,000 troops and about 20 of our partner nations.
It's yet another sign that, as U.S. diplomats have recently said, the U.S. is back and ready to reengage with the world. But unlike his diplomatic counterparts, Rowling did not hesitate to name China as the main U.S. rival for influence on the continent, and to explain why he thinks the U.S. is a better choice.
We continue to provide a preferable alternative to partnering with an actor who may undermine the economic, political, and security institutions, as well as increase instability across the continent of Africa. So our competitive security edge lies primarily with the superiority of our equipment, of our training, of our education, and the other security assistance that we provide. And secondly, with our support to counter terrorist operations across the continent.
General Christopher Cavoli, commanding general of U.S. Army Europe and Africa, was similarly direct when addressing questions about Russia's military ambitions on the continent. Russia recently announced it will establish a naval base in Sudan.
With regard to the Russians specifically, the Russians are using their diplomatic, economic, and in some cases military means to expand their access and influence. And I think that the United States offers Africa more. We offer a different model. We offer stability. We offer counter-violent extremist organization activity, and we offer the promise of democracy, human rights, and the rule of law, which is what the United States has always stood for.
The two generals also noted that although the pandemic may have slowed down their activities on the continent, insurgent and extremist groups seem to have continued their work in 2020. That, they said, is the main challenge they are working with African nations to meet and defeat. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
38 of 39 counties in Kenya yesterday approved the Constitutional Amendment Bill, also known as the Building Bridges Initiative, or the BBI. As Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, the process now goes to the Senate for deliberation and later for a national referendum.
Speaking over the weekend while campaigning for the Building Bridges Initiative, or BBI, opposition leader Raila Odinga, one of the principals of BBI, exuded confidence that the bill will meet the 24 counties threshold by yesterday, Tuesday. In an apparent reference to Deputy President William Ruto, Mr. Odinga rebuked those who he said are against the bill. He called on them to continue opposing it and not change their minds at the last minute.
The coming Tuesday is called the Super Tuesday. Super Tuesday, we want to get 24 counties approving BBI bill. This is going to help us to move to the next stage. There are people doubting Thomas S. who have been fighting BBI. And we want to tell them, don't change your mind. Continue to oppose BBI. Let us meet with you people on the debate.
Despite claims by BBI opponents that the bill will fail in the Mount Kenya and Rift Valley regions, perceived to be Deputy President Ruto's strongholds, the bill passed successfully, with only Baringo County rejecting it. Baringo County Assembly Majority Leader Lawi Kipchumba told residents of the county after the bill debate that they did not approve the bill because it is not a priority. He said there are more important issues that require immediate attention. He says, we have decided to stand with our people's decision. BBI is a no in Baringo County. And even if you contest the ruling outcome in court and we have to repeat the voting process, we will still vote no. We don't see any importance of the BBI, and it is not even a priority. No one in Baringo County has mentioned having a problem with the current constitution. The problems we have include health and access to safe water. So BBI is not a priority to Kenyans. 27 counties passed the bill yesterday, bringing the total number to 38, exceedingly surpassing the constitutional 24 counties threshold. The bill will now proceed to the next step, which is deliberation at the National Assembly and the Senate before being put to a referendum scheduled for June this year. Council of Governors Chairman Wycliffe Oparanya said the crucial stage of the BBI process has already been completed because the outcome of the deliberations in the National Assembly and Senate does not affect the process.
The most important session was this of the County Assembly. The MPs have no other powers over this bill. It's just now a procedure to pass it through. You have no choice but to pass it as is. Because the critical point, whether they say no, it will go to the referendum.
The amendment bill proposes the expansion of the national executive by adding the office of the prime minister and two deputies. It was born out of the March 2018 ceasefire between President Kenyatta and opposition leader Raila Odinga, which ended hostilities ignited by Odinga's rejection of the 2017 presidential election outcome. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
Botswana President Mokgweetsi Masisi has called for regional cooperation in combating poaching as his country battles unprecedented cases. The country's black rhinoceros faces extinction as poachers from neighboring countries decimated the animal's population. From Habaruni, Botswana, reporter Kundise Dobe has the details.
President Mokgweetsi Masisi says the army should rise up and protect the southern African country's natural resources. Botswana has faced rising incidences of poaching, with the perpetrators mostly from neighboring Namibia, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. The poachers particularly seek rhinoceroses. An estimated 102 have been killed since 2018. President Masisi said poachers target soldiers, with one officer losing his life recently.
The number of poaching incidents, the tactics and boldness employed in targeting Botswana Defense Force members is not only disturbing, but a national security threat as well. This therefore calls for a robust and multilateral approach to combat poaching and related criminal activities.
Conservationist Map Ives believes poaching calls for the involvement of regional countries where most of the poachers originate.
There needs to be an international effort to deal with the trafficking and the demand in Asia. That is ultimately where the success will lie, is reducing the ability to traffic these rhino horns across international boundaries. It needs regional cooperation. We need a lot more intelligence.
Poachers hunt rhinos because their horns sell for thousands of dollars in Asia, where they are used in traditional medicine. The Botswana Army has killed more than 20 poachers in the last year during gunfire exchanges in the thickets of the Okavango Delta, where most of the wildlife is found. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Haburoni, Botswana.
African migrants have been risking their lives to reach Europe through the Sahara Desert and across the Mediterranean Sea in search of a better life. Many have died on the way. Isabel Lua is a Guinean filmmaker with an advice for those African immigrants. Her new film is called The Way.
In my movie, my main character, who named Malik, is a young boy that don't want to go to Europe. He has finished studying and then he wants to make his own business. But his mother doesn't want it. He prefers her son to go to Europe, to cross the desert, to cross the Mediterranean Sea, even if dangerous for his life, but she prefers that, than to stay the country and start his own business. But the boy refused that, and then he took the money that the mom had for him to go, and then start his business with that. That is the topic of my movie.
Tell me, Isabel, why did you decide to make the movie?
I made the movie because lot of people leave my country to Europe. Sometimes it's because they don't have opportunities to get job here. Sometimes it's just to go. Because when you are in my country, it looks like Europe is better than here. That's not true. So when they go, they see by themselves that Europe is more difficult than our country here in Africa. So many people go and die in the Mediterranean Sea or in the desert. That's why I decided to do this movie. To say to people, you can stay in your country and do your own business and then have money more than people who live.
As you know, many of the people who are leaving Africa to go to Europe or the United States are doing so because they say they want better life. Now, is there a message also for, I say, African governments? Because they need employment.
I can tell to the government to help the younger people by going to school, because most of the people who is leaving to Europe, they don't go to school. The government must help the younger people to get job here in the country.
What do you have in your film, in your movie, about life in Europe?
No, in my movie, I don't show life in Europe in my movie. I just show life here in the country and what can life be if you stay here and if you work. I just show the life of my main character before he started his own business and after he started it.
Where can people see your movie? Are you showing it to the Guinean people or where can they see it?
I am showing it to Guinean people now because I took my movie and then I brought it in the universities, to the schools, and then my movie is now to the TV, okay?
Isabel, thank you so much for talking with us on Daybreak Africa.
Okay, you're welcome. I'm very sorry for my bad English. I am in a French country, so it's not easy for me to improve my English.
Your English is better than my French. All I know is bonjour, comment ça va, and that's it.
That's true. My English is better than your French.
Isabel Lua is a Guinean filmmaker. Her film is called The Way. She was speaking with us from the Guinean capital, Conakry. And that's it for this Wednesday, February 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a good day.